Hello, Marian Galevich here from the EIN eLearning Editorial Board. We would love your feedback on EINcast, Weekly Neurology. Please help us to learn more about you, our listeners, and plan the future of EINcast by taking our short survey. If you do, you can enter our prize draw for the chance to win free registration for the EIN Congress 2025 in Helsinki. The survey will be online until the end of December 2024. Just look for the link in the episode description. And now, we hope you enjoyed today's episode.
Welcome to EINcast, your weekly source for education, research, and updates from the European Academy of Neurology.
Hello and welcome to EINcast, Weekly Neurology. My name is Francesco Pasini, and I am a clinical neurologist from Niguarda Hospital in Milan, Italy. My main subspecialties are epilepsy and stroke, and today I moderate this podcast as a member from the EIN Coordinating Panel on Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion in Neurology. This month's topic is sex and gender in neurology, and in today's episode, we will talk about inclusive communication with sexual and gender minorities. My guest today is Dr. Keenan Russell. They are Senior Policy Officer at ILGA Europe. Welcome, Keenan, and thank you for joining us today.
Thanks very much, Francesca, for having me. I'm excited for our conversation.
Me too. So first of all, Dr. Russell, Keenan, what is ILGA Europe?
ILGA Europe is the European region of the International Lesbian, Gay, Bisexual, Trans, and Intersex Association. We are a regional membership network with about 700 member organizations across 54 countries in Europe and Central Asia. And our work focuses on two main issues with respect to the rights and needs of LGBTI people in the region. The first of them is about movement building and resource mobilization. So we do a great deal of capacity building, programmatic development, and re-granting to LGBTI organizations and groups in Europe and Central Asia. And the other is regional advocacy work. We work with the Council of Europe, the European Union, a bit with the United Nations and some other institutions to try to advance legislation and policy on the rights of LGBTI people in the region as well. And that's the team that I come from in the organization.
Perfect. Thank you. So I would like to start our chat saying that studies on neurological diseases in LGBTQI plus community are absolutely lacking. We almost have no data on this population, but we have one single study published from the US saying that this population experienced stigma from doctors. So, Keenan, do you think this could be plausible? And if true, can you give some hypotheses about the causes and perspectives from your job?
Absolutely. Firstly, I think the finding of exposure to stigma and discrimination, while limited around neurology specifically, when talking about healthcare in general, is indeed well evidenced at this point. Starting in 2019, the European Union's Fundamental Rights Agency asked questions about whether LGBTI people experienced discrimination in healthcare and social service settings. And they repeated that question again last year in their LGBTI survey series. And there's a clear indication that that this type of stigma and discrimination is prevalent. In 2019, 16% of LGBTI respondents said that the last experience of discrimination they had was in health or social services. And in 2023, that number was 14%, so not significant change across time there. And that's only talking about the most recent experience of discrimination, not lifetime exposure to discrimination. And that's looking broadly at LGBTI people as an entire group. When you sort of dive into some of the subpopulations, for example, trans women, almost 40% of trans women, the most recent exposure to discrimination that they experienced was in a healthcare or social services setting from the 2023, the most recent version of the Fundamental Rights Agency survey. So I do think that the finding of that one study, while largely an anecdote because of the prevalence of studies in the field, is supported by broader healthcare evidence. I think that there are three main issues to pay attention to about why or what's happening. One of them is that LGBTI people in general do not feel able to talk to their providers about their sexual orientation, gender identity, or expression, or sex characteristics because of a fear of discrimination. That's because of the structure of our societies and the frequency with which LGBTI people and issues are presented in negative ways, the types of comments that people receive or see online, and that creates a fearful structure that they live with, and they make decisions day by day about who and how much they will be out in their life. The second is more focused on healthcare specifically, which is that the healthcare setting has a history explicitly of discriminating against LGBTI people. Before the 1970s, homosexuality was classified as a mental illness. Up until only 2019, so just 5 years ago, trans identities were classified as a mental illness. And we continue to see all intersex variations classified by the World Health Organization as diseases. And this type of categorization of our identities and our bodies as illnesses means that any interface with the medical system may well result in pathologizing us and our experience. And the third piece is closely linked to that, which is that many people from LGBTIQ communities, and particularly trans and intersex people, experience something that these communities call broken arm syndrome, where a medical provider will hear their medical complaints and then say, maybe it is because you are LGBTI that you are having these complaints. So your arm hurts, it looks like it's broken, but let's check your hormone levels first before getting you an x-ray. And while that sounds a bit maybe hyperbolic, it's indeed a common experience, particularly for trans and intersex people, where any complaint that they may have going to see a medical provider first needs to be filtered through their being trans and or intersex before they can get the basic workup and treatment that they might need for any type of general healthcare. So all of these things together create a system where accessing and feeling comfortable in healthcare is a long way off, unfortunately.
Thank you very much for this perspective. Also, when I read this study, I thought also, I mean, personally speaking, as a doctor, like, of course, this community is discriminated also by doctors and healthcare, because we doctors, nurses, are a member of the worldwide community. We are people. We are inside the community. So if they are discriminated from the community, of course, also us, it is a part of the problem, you know? This is my humble opinion, not expert opinion, of course. Keenan, so do we need to study to talk with an LGBTQI plus person, or could you provide us some useful and easy tips to use when talking to a non-binary person?
Sure. I think the first piece of this idea, is about general interpersonal respect and the ways that we, one, want other people to treat us, and finding ways to treat others in that way, sort of the golden rule, if you will. When it comes to LGBTI people, including trans and non-binary people, a key consideration is if you are not sure how to address someone, how to react to something, what terminology to use, as you would in any situation where you're trying to respect someone and you don't know enough, ask in a polite and respectful way. And then once they answer the question, do what they've told you. So if you're not sure what name to use with someone, what pronouns, how to refer to their body, open the conversation. I'm sorry, this is new to me. I just want to check to make sure that I'm being respectful. And then when they provide you with an answer, make note of it in their chart so that during that one intervention, as well as any in the future, you're able to follow their instructions and treat them with the type of terminology that they want and need. There are absolutely a lot of specific types of interventions that a healthcare practitioner could make in their practice that make the practice more accessible or friendly to LGBTIQ people. And one way to work on developing that type of information is to get in touch, for example, with the LGBTI medical students organization in your country or from your university. They're so prolific now, and those folks have good guidance for working with LGBTI clients and patients, or to get in touch with LGBTI organizations at the local level who are really happy to talk with professionals across a variety of professions, including healthcare, about how to improve their practice and its inclusivity. There are frequently at universities small courses held by LGBTI organizations to try to do professional development in the medical sphere that are also designed to help you understand exactly what types of questions you need to ask in your practice and how to make adjustments. This can include things like ensuring that your intake forms do not have questions that presume heterosexuality or presume that the clients are cisgender, that your bathrooms are accessible. So if you have one single stall bathroom in the practice, that it has a sign that makes clear that anyone is allowed to use it, that when your administrative staff welcome people into your practice, that they don't unnecessarily presume the gender identity of the person. So instead of saying Miss Smith, saying Alexa Smith and allowing Alexa, whose name you have but pronouns you don't, to provide pronouns and salutations rather than going based on the sex marker that is in the file. And then I think finally, one of the more complicated pieces is, as I mentioned before, around communicating about bodies. We have a tendency in society, but even in the medical sphere, to not speak about bodies and body parts in explicit ways, not to talk about genitalia or breasts or whatever, or even to talk about estrogen and testosterone, but instead to use euphemisms, female body parts, male body parts, female hormones, male hormones. And that's one of the more complicated pieces of communication, is to find ways to sort of remove that type of comms from our engagement with patients and clients, so that when we're talking about estrogen, which is a hormone that essentially everyone has, we're not sort of creating a space for our patients where they think that our understanding is of the body and of the hormone is so binary and so limited. And so talking about estrogen, and if you need to explain what estrogen is so that the patient understands, taking a moment to make that explanation, but using the appropriate terminology. These are just a handful of little ticks, but I strongly encourage getting in touch with local organizations who can give you also the locally culturally sensitive information that changes language to language, country to country, sometimes even city to city.
So we could say that first rule always, also with the LGBTI population community, is just kindness, I would say. You know, just ask. Ask what they're confident with. And I have to say that at least this in Italy, I mean, it's for sure a way, maybe, I would say more inclusive, even if it's more distant between people. We always call patients in the ambulatory setting, outpatient setting, from with numbers. Yeah, it's less effective, but still something does. I don't know. So
it certainly avoids this problem, yeah. I think.
Just one small question before going on with the episode. I was saying LGBTQI plus population. You're always saying LGBTI population. So very briefly, what is the difference?
Okay. The Q generally stands for queer, which is a very broad term that can include sexual orientations and gender identities and expressions that are non-normative. There is some increasing use of the Q and of queer in European political and funding space. The issue for us as ILGA Europe is that our acronym is set by our membership, and the Q has some historical negative connotations. So particularly older LGBTI people, though some younger LGBTI people as well, find queer to be quite a negative and offensive term. And our membership so far has not decided that they want to use it. The plus is a even more amorphous part of the acronym. It can include people who are aromantic or asexual, people who are polyamorous, who have more than one romantic partner. And that amorphousness also makes it difficult to pin down in a policy context. And our membership has also decided not to use a plus so far. So when I speak, I say LGBTI because that's what I've been trained during my time working at ILGA Europe to say. Though there will be local acronyms that the movement locally will use and promote. And so paying attention to your local LGBTI organization and what acronym they use is the best way to know which one to use. And if there are terms within that acronym that you don't know, again, just ask and people will take the time to explain them.
Perfect. So just ask always. So the EN is currently working on a glossary for the LGBTQI plus patients to provide a useful tool for European neurologists when communicating with non-binary people. So also, you actually are one of our external revisors. And some critics replied that forcing language change is not a solution and only alienates people who are already skeptical about certain issues. So, Keenan, what do you think about this? And do you believe that skepticism could also happen within the medical community, forcing the language?
Yeah, I think this is a really great question, Francesco. Firstly, whether an individual accepts LGBTI people or not doesn't change that LGBTI people exist and need access to healthcare services and have the same fundamental human rights as everyone else. So setting that point as our starting point of conversation, LGBTI people need access to health and have the right to it at the same level as everyone else. What is well evidenced by the literature on access to healthcare in general for LGBTI people is that when practitioners or even the staff in a healthcare setting use anti-LGBTI or LGBTI-phobic terminology in their practice, LGBTI people have lower health outcomes and access healthcare less frequently or avoid going to see a doctor or change the doctor more frequently than is medically necessary or medically indicated. And when we think about the role of the profession of healthcare to first do no harm, the assertion that I would make is that not taking the time to reflect the needs of your patients back to them is in itself harmful in this context. LGBTI patients need to feel that they can talk about the entirety of themselves with their provider, and to do that without risk of discrimination, exclusion, of poor treatment. And this conversation about the glossary is directly linked with that. Because if a provider is using antiquated terminology or offensive terminology, LGBTI patients won't feel that they're able to fully trust that experience, and are likely to withhold information to seek treatment later, and thus when a condition is further progressed, or to avoid seeking treatment altogether.
Thank you very much. So to summarize for take-home messages, we could say that I was wrong, as it there are many evidences in Europe that LGBTQI plus population has been and is being discriminated every day from also from healthcare setting. So we could say that first rule, always ask to the patient, be kind and ask what pronouns they are confident or with, and if there are any way to communicate they would feel confident. And also always referring and do a little search maybe to local communities, LGBTQI plus communities, and the pronouns and of course the words they use to let your patient feel listened and heard. And also I would say that choosing the language we are referring to our patient is the first point of the treatment, because also language is an important need for health and is an important point for the health of our patients. So we really thank Dr. Keenan Russell for joining us in this episode of ENCast and invite you not to miss the upcoming episodes. Thank you.
Thanks very much.
This has been EANcast Weekly Neurology. Thank you for listening. Be sure to follow us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your preferred podcatcher for weekly updates from the European Academy of Neurology. You can also listen to this and all of our previous episodes on the EAN campus to gain points and become an EAN expert in any of our 29 neurological specialties. Simply become an EAN individual member to gain access. For more information, visit ean.org/membership. That's ean.org/membership. Thanks for listening. ENCast Weekly Neurology is your unbiased and independent source for educational and research-related neurological content. Although all content is provided by experts in their field, it should not be considered official medical advice.